Good evening. It's September 11th, 2014. I'm Beth Ann Kosovich. Tonight on Town Square, the journey from the original attack to today. As the enemy has changed and keeps morphing while attracting nationals from the Western world, is the U.S. responding well enough? Our panel will consider that question and others. And a programming note, to bring you this conversation, we've had to record the show, so the phone lines are unavailable. Here's our panel. Carlos Juarez is a political science professor and chair of the Department of Social Sciences at Hawaii Pacific University. A specialist in international relations, he teaches courses on peace building and conflict management and the politics of developing nations. Brad Glosserman is also here. He's the executive director of the Pacific Forum Center for Strategic and International Studies in Honolulu. It has provided policy-oriented analysis and promoted dialogue on regional security, political, economic, and environmental issues in the Asia-Pacific regions. Retired U.S. Army Colonel John Hansen is a veteran of two tours in Afghanistan. Now he works as a peace, security, and development consultant for Camber Corporation. And finally, we have with us Lieutenant Colonel Wendy Marotta. She is a reservist in the U.S. Marine Corps, now working on a master's. Thank you all for making the time, and welcome to Town Square.
Thank you for having us here, Bethann.
Thank you.
I'm glad to join you here.
Nice to be back.
And nice to have you back, too. We've gone from shock and anger when 9/11 first happened to shock and awe, and over the last couple of weeks, just a whole lot of shock. When we started with this war on terror, was that really a misnomer to be able to get the American public behind what had to happen over a very long time? Did we do ourselves a disservice in calling it that? John, we'll start with you.
Now, that word war has a lot of stuff attached to it. In the pure sense, war is declared. The American people, through their representation in Congress, sign up for it. And it's a big deal. So calling something a war on terror is a bit of a departure from, the purist doctrine. But getting back to the emotional attachment that a population has to such an event, when we're attacked, a war on terror, a war on whatever attacked us, is appropriate. It was appropriate back at 9/11. Different situations, I think, now prevail.
How do you see that path from where we started to where we are now?
Well, I think we had tremendous support, almost unanimous support from the population, certainly after 9/11, as expected. The way that the war was prosecuted in various campaigns, Afghanistan being one, the Philippines being another, by the way, which is still ongoing as a campaign within this war. This amorphous non-state actor of terror is a bit of a challenge. And so ending a war in its classic sense is in itself a challenge. So it's been prosecuted by way of the international system, states trying to rectify and get back normalcy, but really not getting at this tactic, terrorism in general. It's amorphous and difficult to get at.
Wendy, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, too, of what we started with and what you see as being the path that we've taken since 9/11, 2001.
Well, I think that John is spot on when he talks about the war on terror and that that was the appropriate response at 9/11. However, I think that where we needed to focus policy and our actions is recognizing that terror is a tactic, and that what we needed to be focused on was the root cause, which is extremism. And extremism is different in different parts of the world and isn't exclusive to Islamic extremism. So I think that a better focus as we transition from the visceral response to 9/11 and the initiation of the war against the extremists, that we needed to evolve better to maybe a more sophisticated understanding of what it is we needed to fight as we went into different campaigns, if you will, to win the long war.
We're going to come back to some of those points that you just made, but I also want to get Brad Glosserman and Carlos Juarez to weigh in on how you see this 13-year journey that we've been on since 9/11, 2001. Carlos?
Well, I think as we've heard from others, I would echo that in the sense that when we think of the notion, and maybe the term itself, war, it can be seen as a misnomer. Many critics have been able to show how, in a sense, it's contentious, But in some ways, it can be either exploited by different participating governments and others who are, you know, trying to advance their own policy or military objectives, whether it's reducing civil liberties or just being part of the alliance. The other is just the idea that these past wars that we had tended to be a different type, where we had a clear identified enemy, where we had maybe, you know, an end game. And the challenge of this, much like maybe the war on drugs, these are conflicts that are not as clear and they're unlikely to end. And in some ways we have to figure out how can we best manage it, how can we reach a level where it's either tolerable or at least more manageable. It's not going to be the nice end of previous wars. You know, I'm speaking maybe in the early 20th, mid-20th century, or even before. This is really an ongoing challenge that we're going to continue to face.
Brad Glosserman.
You know, the war phraseology is problematic on a couple of levels. First, I think the degree to which we lashed out, and as John said, we responded very emotionally to an attack on the homeland. And it's not clear to me that we thought about really what we were doing other than getting some sort of revenge, if you will, and trying to make people that had hurt us pay in response. So if you're going to begin those kind of activities, you need to figure out where you're going to go, what your objective is, what your exit strategy is ultimately. It's not clear to me in any way that we did think through all of that, whether we were prepared, as Wendy suggested, to understand and address the root causes, and whether we had the understanding of the facts on the ground in any of these environments as to what we were actually up against and what the realities were as opposed to how we chose to see what we took to be the givens in these particular circumstances and the series of campaigns, as she mentioned as well. And so I think we mistook in some cases our hopes and some people's overactive imaginations and ambitions for what was possible. And the final piece of this, I think, which is important as well, is that wars have traditionally been fought, certainly in the last 100 years or so, by nations. And what we've seen particularly in this has been a way of insulating the American public, and this I think goes to John's point as well, from the real effects of this war, that we never had to pay for it. We never had to really understand what we were fighting for, and because there had to be a cost to the American public for them to appreciate, I think, what was moving forward. And we never did. Consequently, this has allowed us to distance ourselves from what we're doing and the consequences of those decisions. And as a result, I think we've made a number of mistakes, tactical, operational, strategic, and perhaps even political.
All right, we're going to get to some of those too. Where we are now and the points that several of you have made about how the American public looks at, whether you want to call it the war on terrorism as opposed to the war on terror, but how we look at the last couple of weeks. Most people are feeling revulsion at the idea that someone could be beheaded, let alone being confronted with a piece of film that shows this. But from everything that you've all just said, it doesn't seem like that's enough to galvanize the kind of response that we saw initially or that might be necessary to change the way we approach this so-called war going forward. Would that be true, Brad?
If I may, and at the risk of sounding callous, and I think this has been one of the discussions that you hear within the policy circles, is that as disgusting, revolting, inhuman, terroristic, whatever the appropriate adjective you want to apply to what we've seen from ISIS, which is what we're referring to in the last couple of weeks, it is not clear that these acts rise to the level at which they threaten the United States' national interest. And if you're going to go to war, then you have to have a rationale that obliges you to engage the entirety of the American national power and the American public will. Anything less than that is a recipe for defeat. No matter what, it means that we'll be making mistakes because we're not focused, we're not thinking, and we're not using the many assets that we have. Beheading these journalists is a terrible, inhumane thing to do. But at this moment, it is unclear to me and I think to many folks that are making the important decisions how ISIS constitutes, by virtue of those particular acts at this moment, a genuine threat to the United States and U.S. national interests. Doesn't mean we shouldn't deal with them, but it doesn't mean we should be going to war with them either.
John, they seem to be, though, the one that we're focusing on now. And there have been many factions and factions that are competing with each other, factions competing for, you know, recruitment ranks, all of that. And yet we don't seem to be able to take notice of all those nuanced layers of this. Do we need to develop a better way of talking about this within the public sphere to sensitize ourselves more to those kinds of points that both you and Brad and all of you, frankly, have made in this conversation so far?
I would say with a lot of confidence that all of the nuance that you mentioned is understood. The fact of the matter is it's highly protected information. To make that public is a bit problematic. But again, I'm fairly confident that the administration and particularly the defense sector is fairly informed by a lot of that. Now, to your point is, how do you rally the public around this looming danger without revealing your information and, more importantly, your sources? That's a tough one. I'd also add that within the context of this current issue looming in the Levant, the ISIS, Syria and Iraq, is the fact that we've got two failing states. We have a neighborhood that's, although it seems to be growing concerned itself, is fairly inactive to address the issue themselves. All this, it makes the whole effort tremendously complicated for us, I think, as a nation, particularly in light of our experiences over the last decade in Iraq and how that's all ended. So my sensing, there's a tremendous amount of caution across the general public about another foray there. But to your point, a revelation of the real threat would, I think, be cause for people to think about what can we do that would preempt, you know, another 9/11.
Can I just real quick? Just
all right, Brad, jump in here.
John's comment about an inactive region, which I think is really ironic because this I think goes to the larger questions of strategy that we've talked about and understanding what's going on the ground. And the fact of the matter is the region is incredibly active. But the problem is that it's not acting in the same way. The supporters of ISIS or the Islamic State, there's actually a very, very credible think tank in Washington that works on nuclear security and strategic issues called ISIS and is being having big issues because their name is being
co-opted.
But anyway, so let's try to call it the Islamic State. Is that, you know, countries that are ostensibly American allies in the Middle East and they are actually supporting ISIS. And it is there is a multi-layered game going on right now in the region between control, for example, among Arab states and secular states and Islamic groups and more and less Islamic on top of the Shia-Sunni split. So some of our best buddies, both here and in Afghanistan, are actually supporting these organizations that are undermining American interests. So there's a lot of activity here. And the problem on the larger strategic sense is we really need to be addressing the fact that people that on the one hand are our friends and partners, on the other hand are doing things that are serving their national interests and undermine our own.
Which seems to back us right back into a point about talking about Pakistan and some of what we don't really think about in public conversations about this. And I appreciate John's point that some things that just have to remain, you know, under secure wraps or one thing, but knowing that there are these multiple layers and there isn't just this one big bad guy, fill in the blank, you lop him off, everything will be fine, or you get rid of this faction, everything will be fine. Understanding that, Wendy, seems to go back to the idea that we don't seem to understand the varied levels of what all this terrorism is like in different regions, which goes right back to your point about understanding regionality and how that plays into our public policy or in our foreign policy.
Well, and I don't think that it's necessarily that we don't understand it. And I go to Brad's point about insulating the American public and educating the American public about the complexities of these problems and that there's policy decisions that have to be made that are hard decisions. And we have allies that we rely on for certain things, but that are they often have their own motivations, their own strategies, and they use tactics such as terror that are not in concert with our belief system and our value system, but yet we have to work with these partners. So it's a very difficult problem. But then it also gets back to, I think, John's very good point about failing states. And this is another piece that, again, you know, we get very focused in the media about an individual, an organization, and what's going on in, you know, in the immediate events of the day. But what we're not looking at is the critical impact that failing states has on the spread of these extremist groups because it offers them safe haven. And safe haven is critical for many of these groups that have found it in now ISIS in Syria and Iraq, but for a long time in Pakistan. And recognizing that the safe haven afforded to al-Qaeda, Taliban, and other groups in Pakistan has prolonged the war in Afghanistan, if you will, the insurgency in Afghanistan, and that helping and really focusing the American public on recognizing this is a long process. We as a probably more of a global community, not just the U.S., but we've got to be invested in this because without security, without the rule of law, without governments that are effective, then you're going to have these safe havens. You're going to have ungoverned spaces. And that's really what provides that center of gravity for a lot of these groups.
Carlos weigh in here with all this, because we seem to be developing some themes with all this, that there is this knowledge, but the American people really don't necessarily know it perhaps as well as they should. They tend to be a little bit more simplistic in the way that they look at some of this, and they just want to go bomb something.
Yeah.
And what, you know, Wendy and John and Brad have been suggesting, and you too, is that this is so far beyond that kind of a strategy. And yet within the last week and a half, we've heard the president misspeak and say something which sounded like we didn't really have a strategy for all of this.
Yeah.
Clearly set a lot of people off. How do you focus that kind of a message coming from the president, with also the need to educate the public a little bit more about some of these complexities so that people can maybe get behind a long-term effort with some real fervor?
Well, this is the challenge that I think any leader has, because the world we live in, we see it's complicated, the answers are not easy, and yet as a public and maybe as just a citizen, we want to see answers, we want to see solutions that are quick. I often look at this as, on one hand, and we've heard a lot of evidence here, I mean, there's a lot of understanding of the world and the region and the issues, and they're complicated issues. There's a lot of expertise on that region of the world that we're talking about. There's a lot of disconnect, however, in that maybe the population here in the U.S. as a whole, you know, while we have experts in many places, many people don't have a deep understanding of the issues, and they want to see it in a more black or white. That region of the world, the Middle East and specifically, I mean, you've got a lot of different divides and challenges, whether it's within the Arab cultures and, you know, Shia and Sunni splits, or the Arab-Israeli aspect, or even the difference between Persians and Iran that are not Arabs. And yet, I often also describe this as you have a need for an understanding of the international, the global, these things. But you also, in a democracy like ours, our leaders must have the support, the legitimacy of a population that supports them. And so there's the domestic, and you might see this as sort of the challenge of the, I don't know, the intermestic, if you want to make up a word there. Somehow the link of the two, and they're not always there. Again, just the idea that the options are not easy ones, that they are complicated. There's no way around that. Our media, I think, becomes critical here, and it's easy to criticize it because they want to simplify things. They even drive some of the hysteria and taking things in like a snapshot of something. Of course, we're all horrified by the picture of a beheading. Who would not be? But what's the answer? What are we going to do? I mean, the solutions are not quick and easy. And you described the president and his recent announcement. Again, you know, we don't have a strategy. Well, we have strategies. We have multiple strategies, but there's just no quick and easy one that's going to solve that problem.
Brad.
If I may offer a couple of remarks that sort of tie some things together. First, I mean, into this, the famous Obama, we have no strategy. What he was actually saying is we have no strategy to deal militarily with IS in Syria. It was a very specific question. It was a very specific answer, and it was a very thoughtful one. And I think it goes precisely to the point that John and Wendy have been making, that we need to be thinking ahead. You don't go rushing willy-nilly emotionally into a situation and making sure you don't make it worse. That's number one. Number two, I think related to that is we have a U.S. leadership that at this moment, the president, I think, recognizes that this is a country that is war-weary. I mean, you look at the national security strategy that was written in 2010, and that is we're fatigued by a decade of war. Afghanistan's the longest war the United States has ever fought, and we're still there. We're not out yet. And consequently, there is no stomach in the American public for another incursion, another invasion, another kinetic exercise in ways that go beyond the drone strikes that we're doing right now. And so the public doesn't want more. Yet at the same time, the public seeks, I think, an emotional catharsis of a response and something that simplifies a complex world. And yet they want the Americans to – they want us to lead. They want our country to lead, but they don't want us to fight a war. They don't want us to get involved, and yet they don't want to have to deal with the emotional and otherwise the complexities of the world beyond our borders. There aren't simple answers. And the final piece of this, where we started this particular thread, is the ignorance of the American public. You know, Wendy was talking about you have to deal with root causes, and absolutely correct. And the problem, though, is that for a decade ago, we had a government that didn't want to address that, that felt as though that really wasn't our role. Our job was to spank bad people and to get out and let the things sort themselves out. And so now, if you're going to address root causes, if you want to drain the swamp, as I like to put it, what you have to do is to it's not only denying the safe havens, but it's denying the people that go to the safe havens. And you have to give people something to live for rather than something that they're prepared to die for. To do that, we have to invest. And now we go to the American public, which is they will invariably and across the board for the last several decades, you ask the American public about overseas development assistance or our aid, and they'll tell you it's we can cut that and balance the budget. It's 30% of the U.S. budget. It's less than 1%. And it is an appalling and abysmally low number. So it is emotional demands. It is rank ignorance. It is intelligence that is intelligence, I mean in terms of the thinking capacity of a leadership, that is at odds with a demand for an order in a world that is inherently messy and complex.
I wanted to add to that, and I think that it's an important point when we talk about strategy and the American public's understanding of it. And I want to point out two of the, I guess, the success stories when we talk about strategy and countering extremism and terrorism here in the Pacific. And I think they're really extraordinary examples that strategy that has been put in place over a number of years and has been effective. When we look at Bangladesh is, although not perfect, and they have had some issues recently with their electoral process. However, we've worked closely with them. We've worked with their government. We've worked with their law enforcement. We've shared intelligence. And a great part of this initiative has been with the Pacific Command here in Hawaii, and as well as with successive ambassadors in Bangladesh who understood the importance of working with the government and getting them, we call it, by, with, and through, working with the host nation country and helping them to see that it's in their best interest to combat extremism. And they have done a phenomenal job in Bangladesh in doing that. We can also look at Indonesia, one of the largest Muslim populations in the world. And years ago, the U.S. and Australia partnered together to help the Indonesians stand up an organization that would go after the extremists in their country. And both of these countries have also embraced not just the law enforcement aspect of it, but also the education aspect of it, where they have injected education into the madrasa systems that also combats extremism. So I think, there is strategy out there, and the U.S. government and the U.S. military have been very engaged in that. And those things tend to not get the press because, the focus is on, the horrid acts that go on, and that's where we all tend to go.
And that tends to also go back to Carlos's point about the failure of the media in a lot of ways, and also to Brad's point about the ignorance of the American people.
But educating the American public on these success stories, I think, would then go towards Brad's point, is helping the American public recognize this is a long-term problem that we are going to be grappling with, well into the future. But when we have deliberate strategies that encompass the whole of government, we see that it works. That obviously there's differences between the Middle East and Asia, but it's definitely something that we need to appreciate better.
So how do we move from that point of duality where you have war fatigue on the part of the American public and also this need to want to fix this thing? And then you might want to even throw in there the other idea that we like things done fast
and
cheap. And it's not going to happen quickly. It's not going to happen inexpensively. And we're going to have to be able to see that to be able to, forgive me, win those hearts and minds and all that other kind of stuff that we're all always told, to be able to take this campaign well into the future in a concerted effort with other nations where we're actually respecting the fact that they know their systems pretty well, they know their peoples pretty well, and that we're not going to just go in there and do a bombing campaign, John?
Well, I think you've used the right word, campaign, and to touch on what Wendy's just described, within a campaign in the military sense, you've got phasing, and phase zero is where you have a tremendous amount of effort, which is what Wendy just described. All that activity was within this zero phase prior to any ratcheting up of the use of force. That's where the war on terror, oddly enough, is best fought. And I think going back to our really kind of challenge with the duration of these fights, it's the reality that when a country decides to use force, it does so within an international system of rational actors. State-on-state conflict is inevitably what happens. And so going after a non-state actor within that context vastly complicates things, because what you uncover after, in the case of Afghanistan, you eliminate the infrastructure of the terror organization within months of invasion. You have a regime change even before then, within the country. Now you've uncovered the issues of safe haven and ungoverned space and all those things that create these vacuums. And so the use of force, I think, if we elect to do that, we ought to learn from our experiences, particularly in Operation Enduring Freedom Afghanistan, that it's going to be a long haul. So the phase zero effort really ought to be given tremendous amount of resource and effort to keep us from taking that step for the use of force.
Tonight on Town Square, we're looking at the journey that we've taken from the original attack to today. Just a quick programming note to be able to bring you this conversation. We've had to record it, so the phone lines are not available. As the enemy has changed and keeps morphing, how are we coping? Tonight, our panel is considering that question and others. As you've been talking, I've been watching Carlos Suarez make notes. I know you want to comment on this, too.
Well, I maybe putting on my educator hat, because I'm thinking more, you know, how do we get a better understanding for particularly our youth, people who are, you know, coming into the world as young adults and future leaders, more importantly, because they're inheriting this new world we are living in now, in which, again, we have new conflicts, the nature of conflict is different. I think it's very critical that we have to have people who understand the world by going to it and seeing it. And what I mean by that is you can learn everything as you need to in class and study and read your history, but there's nothing to substitute for visiting, traveling, working, studying in another foreign place and getting out of your comfort zone, understanding that different people see the world differently. You know, if you travel to a poor, underdeveloped country, you realize that their day-to-day affairs are, you know, more basic and fundamental, and they need development, on a different level than what you might find in other places. The other is that you begin to understand not just the cultures you're seeing or experiencing, but you understand more about your own, what your values are, and what they stand for. So we live in a world today in which the nature of our world, our economy, we work with people from all over the world, and you may do that online as a virtual community, or you have. Again, the population in our country is changing demographics. Here in Hawaii, we experience that because we have people from the world. But parts of the mainland today where 30, 50 years ago were very homogeneous today are dealing with, you know, people from different parts of the world. And we need to understand that, the challenges we face, particularly on the global level, require us to work together and to find common solutions. And that means working with people who, again, have different values, different ways of seeing it. So that's the challenge, I think. So I'm a big proponent of experiencing, exchange, get out, do a study abroad, do a travel, or otherwise find ways to connect with the communities here.
That's going to make a lot of parents nervous, and it may make a lot of students nervous, too, if they're seeing some of what we've been watching over the last couple of weeks, and knowing that that's going to move into the future, too. Striking that balance, as you say, is going to be tough. Also, when you go someplace else and you are confronted with that and you realize that, you know, your rules don't always apply, the feeling of being isolated and maybe fearful, particularly with kids, who are college age, is that too much for them?
Well, I think it's vital.
Too much for us to expect from them because they certainly don't know a whole lot about geography.
Yes. No, and here's what I would say very adamantly, in that, we often have misperceptions of the world out there. And I happen to be a Latin American, and I spent time in Colombia and South America. About 20 years ago, I was living there at a very tough time, and understandably, people would have fear to go there. Today, Latin America is a very dynamic place, a lot of important, exciting things happening. And if you go there, it's not a lawless, chaotic pace. People aren't, killing you randomly. There's, like any place, some insecurity, but you can find that in any urban center. Maybe what I'm really getting at is that until you go out and see the world, you come to realize that a lot of the hysteria we see on maybe just the focus on the drama and the violence. I mean, most people are living pretty dignified and respectable lives, and even in harsh conditions have a lot of positive things happening, a lot of exciting, innovative, creative things. And we need to see that. We need to tell those stories, and we need to experience that.
Brad, you look like you want to be able to say something about this.
There's a part of me that wants to be greatly cynical about some of this discussion.
Well, you can do that.
I probably will. But let me try to tie it together with the larger theme that where we started the conversation and to go to a point that John made and expand on it and address as well the comments, well, all of what we're talking about, because that's the way I do this stuff. John talked about the way that we're dealing – a world traditionally has been wars of states on state conflict. And in fact, it's now we're moving to a an environment in which you've got more non-state actors, and that requires us to rethink. And I think that this goes to the questions that you're discussing with Carlos right now about a transition in the global system, and that what's happened is that people are profoundly unnerved about the way that strictures upon which they are accustomed to operating and about assumptions they had about how the world worked no longer work. Now, we're most associated and most familiar with those at home, and we're seeing that as Carlos talks about the way that communities are changing and that we have new forces of globalization, and that at the same time, what we have by virtue of the media is the ability to see much more immediately and much more closely these incongruities. And our lives are more pressed, I think, if you will, the certainties. And quite frankly, this is a larger and slightly off subject, not necessarily, but I think the idea that Barack Hussein Obama, a black man, has become the president of the United States in 2008, also for certain communities pushes home the idea of the changes, the radical shifts in the world, and certain verities with which they were very comfortable have gone away. And this is – he becomes representative of that. And I think, again, this is a larger political discussion, but I think it's important. And while we're dealing with that in, for example, in the Muslim world, you see the same forces pulling apart these societies. And we see that in every – we talk about the incredible development that's happening in East Asia and the riches that are being bestowed or being garnered by this new dynamic region. Well, it's also completely uprooting traditional social structures. As you have this mass migration from rural populations to the cities, you have at the same time a complete upending of the social order. And in Russia right now, what we're seeing is Vladimir Putin trying to – combat, if you will, the death of the great Russian image for which he and so many other Russians are wedded to. So in this particular world, what you're seeing is the falling apart. And as people lose these traditional verities, as I keep saying, they, I think, are more quicker to resort to more extreme action because they see this as being comforting and they have something considerably less to lose. All of this is occurring as the world changes at a time when the structures of global governance are eroding and the power – the institutions that we had to run the world were set up in a very particular world order in 1945 and a few years after that. That's gone. That world doesn't exist. And yet that's the mechanisms that we use to govern. So consequently, we're trying to adjust and we're using outdated tools. We're trying to come up with new ones. And yet people that are accustomed to having power and having a say in how the world works are now obliged to share it. That's tough because you have to give up your control. And that's what so much of this and so much of the tensions, you know, so much of the unease that we Americans feel reflects is born of this anxiety. And so that's what I think what we really have to address. And that leads us – and I know I'm rabbiting on, but let me add one other point that goes to this discussion about democracy. And that is we live in a country where we elect leaders, and we can't expect the public to know all of these things because it's a complex world and because that's what we have leaders for. And yet when leaders don't do what we want to do, sometimes they call them leaders and sometimes we call them demagogues. And so do we want our leadership leading the public or following the public? That tension is never resolvable, and it tends to very much depend upon what you happen to think of the particular policies of the people you call your head, whether it's the state, the governor, the president, what have you. And so again, reconciling this strikes me as being an incredibly difficult set of imperatives. And this is where I get back to the cynical piece of all this. Having the public understand and be consistent with what it wants. On one given moment, it wants A, and the next minute, it wants to fight, and the next minute, it wants to be comforted. It doesn't want to get involved, but it wants solutions to problems. I think we have to. The media's role in all this, and as a former journalist, I'm troubled by the inevitable result or resort to blaming the media. And right. I say this on Hawaii Public Radio.
Well, you can, but right. You know the point that. We find this happening within the media itself. Do we lead or do we follow what people want to know about? That's the same kind of situation that we very often find ourselves in. But to go back to your point about how it is that we get some of this information out, how do we even have people understand basic geography and understand who we're talking about? That doesn't seem to be at a very high level of security information. That goes back to some other issues that seem to be thwarting a public's understanding and increasing their rate of ignorance. You've all made the case that we need to do more to be able to educate. How do you also do that at the same time that you're dealing with the emotional component that seems to be driving a lot of the information that we're seeing show up in social media, in any form of media, and certainly in a lot of discussion that's taking very strategic parts of this conversation and blowing it up to a point where people are being whipped into a frenzy? How do you get some rational discussion about any of this?
Well, that's tough work. I think the media or various sources that that are available to all of us can be helpful. And there is a tremendous amount of responsibility levied on a media within a democracy, and a tremendous amount of freedom by virtue of that, for good reason. You know, I think Carlos and Brad have both touched on, if we're going to wax kind of philosophic, you know, there are things that are playing out. You know, the past is present. Things that are still playing out in these ancient societies and in nascent geographic locations, boundaries imposed, colonial boundaries, post-colonialism, World War II, the effects of World War II still kind of playing out in parts of Southeast Asia.
And certainly informing our thinking. Brad just mentioned that a moment ago.
Exactly. World War I, actually, the Ottomans.
Yeah. I mean, having even a cursory understanding of churn that's happened in the Middle East would, from a personal individual standpoint, would be very helpful, I think, for the average American to at least see some of the logic to, you know, the tremendous amount of violence and hatred that's generated there. It's, you know, it's a bit curious that that particular part of the world it has this decades and decades, almost a century of issue. Be interesting from an academic standpoint to find out why. So, you know, beyond that, you know, an educated population is tremendous. When I was in Afghanistan, 85-90% illiteracy rates, that's the problem in terms of any growth for that for countries like that. So in a country that's so blessed with so much like America, you know, it's almost a duty for us to study a little bit about the other parts of the world.
Well, we certainly have fallen down the ranks when it comes to real rating where our educational system is. I mean, Finland's up there, Korea's up there. We're not so up there.
Yeah. Well, we've gotten comfortable, and I'll defer to the academics in the crowd here to figure out how we're going to fix that.
Oh, don't call Brad Glasser. I'm an academic. I once did that, and I almost got punched. But, yeah. Carlos, you can take that one.
I mean, it's a challenging issue. You know, on one hand, what we need is to continually be educating ourselves. And the formal part, going to school, is one aspect. But what I'm thinking as I hear all this is that, you know, us as informed, you know, adults and responsible adults have to continually, you know, put it on there.
Once upon a time, if you got to a certain age, you were expected to go out and see some of the world and be looking to the world to be able to find your place in it. You mentioned, John, that we've gotten comfortable with this, but getting comfortable with some of that, having thinking that dates back to World War One, seeing that we're not really doing much to educate ourselves about the longevity that this campaign is going to have, all of that conspiring with a lot of anxiety, angst, and real revulsion at what we're seeing doesn't seem to add up in being able to get everyone behind a very long-term campaign. How do you start to just build where we are right now? What would you do tomorrow if you were able to affect a campaign throughout the United States to be able to shift some of that perception and make this global picture a little bit more visible?
So you're looking to the Marine to figure that one out,
well,
right?
Semper Fi.
Carlos is he said it right. As a mother, I think that from a national security perspective, parenting is really an important piece of all of this, and it's not sexy and it's not high speed, but to Carlos's point of, these are our future leaders, and they need to understand the world in a more sophisticated way than my generation did. When we were faced with 9/11, and, you know, as a Marine officer, when that happened, you know, again, we went into this with one thought in terms of protecting the homeland and going after our enemies. And we need to raise, the younger generation to think more
subtly?
Not subtly. I don't have a problem with bold action, but it has to be from a standpoint of knowledge and understanding. And so much of policy today and our opinion and media today is from a Western perspective. And when we look at things and we turn around, turn the table, and try to look at things from our adversary or our allies or a different cultural perspective, things that seemed irrational, like terrorism, suddenly make sense. And I think that that helps to, in some ways, it reduces that emotional response. Because when you look at terrorism and using terrorism, it's very rational. It's a choice that these organizations are making, and in some cases governments are making, because it works, and it's cheap. And it's, in some cases, it's the only tool that they have, because non-state actors don't have a forum where they can raise their political grievances or their cultural or religious grievances. So when you turn that table by being exposed to these other, you know, countries and cultures, like Professor Juarez is talking about, then you better understand the problem. And then we get at those root causes in a much more, I believe, in a much more effective way. And that's our responsibility. It's the responsibility of every parent in America is to say, you know, my kids, my six-year-olds are foot soldiers of the future. And I'm going to make sure that they're well-educated so they can solve some of these problems.
I agree 1,000% with what Wendy just said, particularly the bit about parenting. The problem, of course, you know, you're dealing with two former military people in this room, a professor of international studies, and I'm not sure where I fit in on this. But these
policy
are people.
Wonk.
Policy wonk. Okay. But people that spend their lives and make their living thinking about and looking at the world as opposed to, as of most people, unfortunately, I think have to look at what's much closer to them, particularly given the complexities and the difficulties they have in navigating what is a rapidly changing world. So as much as I want to believe that, and I think particularly the empathy piece is critical in just so many aspects of human life, that we have to impress upon that, which assumes, of course, we have the resources to teach that, et cetera. And so that's a different discussion. But let me offer you another idea or an underlying concept that, again, has been woven through our conversation thus far. And one of the problems with that, though, is this notion of – or one of the key issues that we confront is the notion of American exceptionalism. Because if you believe we are special and if you believe we are right and we are somehow touched, blessed in so many ways, uniquely so, then why bother looking at it from somebody else's point of view? Because you're right. And I think that we have – and again, this goes back to so many of these pieces about we're special. We have destiny behind us. We have all these other – forces. So we should not be challenged. When we are challenged, we are always justified in what we do. We do not need to understand how other people see it, because ultimately our perspective is the correct one. And threaded through and within the policy wonk world, you know, no American politician is allowed to challenge the very notion of American exceptionalism. And I don't care whether we're talking about President Obama, President Bush, President Carter, President Clinton. If you talk about Senator Rand Paul or Speaker Boehner, go through it. All speak that language of exceptionalism, and you are not allowed to challenge that. And I'm not sure this is incredibly dangerous waters to have suddenly ventured out into, but I would argue that we need to be aware of how that so limits us in terms of whether correct or not. We need to understand how that limits our capacity to understand issues and deal with the world, and how that – true or not, needs to be at least set aside at moments so that we can engage precisely through the prisms of other people's worldviews and experiences, because you have two choices when you encounter someone who disagrees with you. You either beat them down and you force them, compel them to agree with you, which is probably not a very enduring and long-term solution, but in some cases it's all you've got and you have to do it. Well, the second way is you understand what it is that they want, and you offer them, because you are capable of empathizing with their objectives, you are able to offer them a solution that they would willingly embrace because it advances their interests. But if you can't get in their head, sit in their shoes, stand in their shoes and understand what it is they want and how they see the world, you cannot convince them of anything.
John, you want to add to that?
I just wanted to add both to Brad and Wendy's comments. I think we would all agree that there's a tremendous amount of frustration out there, particularly in the have-nots of the world, and globalization is shining a broader light on their having less or not. But I think we need to remember that this terrorism is probably more rooted in good old-fashioned lust for power, criminal activity, mindless, inhumane action by psychopathic folks. And there's, you know, there's this evil kind of milieu that they operate in. Now, having said all that, they leverage the frustration. But I think we ought to be mindful of the very real fact that when someone lops off someone else's head, there's an issue of pathology and evil associated with that. And there's nothing in the world that, regardless of the frustration, that justifies any of that.
And looking at that evil, where a lot of people are focusing attention right now, the real question is, okay, what do we do about that? How do we take care of that right now, and then have all these other overlays that we've all talked about?
You know, if I may, John's absolutely right, and I hope I included that a caveat. There are bad guys out there, and there are people that you just have to cut off their heads. I mean, you have to just stomp them out. You just cauterize that particular wound. And what's interesting to me with this discussion of the Islamic State is, as the research seems to suggest, that most of the really, really bad guys are Westerners, that they're not – that you have people that – for exactly those pathologies have decided this is the world they want to live in. And many of them are just bad characters that are drifting over to that. And they are, of course, complemented by the people that are frustrated and have nothing to lose. And that's a very dangerous combination, because you have to be aware that there are two different sets of problems for you to address, or us to address, as we confront. And I think now we're back to this question of how do you deal with the terrorist threat.
So where do you go from there? Because it's drawing Westerners. And it also has a different component that's state-based, regionalized, so much that we don't really have a good handle on. And yet people want to see something, quote-unquote, done, because they're afraid and they're angry. And they want it, as we've talked about, fast and cheap. So what do you do from this point forward as we're looking at this 9/11? What makes this a point that could be one that really makes a difference in the long-term campaign?
Well, I think you have to go back to the success stories, and you have to look at why they were successful. And they were successful because the governments were involved, and the people, and we talk about empathy and having that understanding that our ways are, you know, of looking at a problem are not always the best solution. And I think that, you know, first and foremost, we have to be very strong about pressuring our partners, our allies in the region to step up and take a greater role in this. Because as we've seen in the Asia-Pacific region, when those regional leaders step up and take action, the people respond. Because these are other people who are like-minded and who have an understanding of their needs, wants, their cultures, their religions, their beliefs. So without that, you know, without Saudi Arabia, you know, stepping up to the plate, and without the U.S. challenging them and saying, you need to be leading this effort, you know, to reduce the extremism in the Middle East as a leader, saying to Iran, you have a leadership responsibility for doing that. I don't think that we're coming out strongly enough, you know, from our policy perspective to our allies to require that they do that, and then to support that effort when it happens.
So specifically, who gets challenged next? What's the very next thing that you would like to see happen as you look at this next year, in which we will be marking another year after 9/11?
You know, at the end of the day, I mean, because we live in this democratic system with an electoral calendar, we're going to see basically domestic politics come into play. And our leaders, I think we heard it put well by Brad a while ago. I mean, they, you know, they have to be mindful if they, you know, like any politician, they want survival in office and you know, keeping their, you know, their party in power. So they have to take positions that are not going to, you know, take them down the wrong path. I guess what I'm getting at is that, I mean, it becomes sort of part of our own domestic political game, and that is hard because it's driven by sound bites. It's driven by, you know, quick, easy answers to complex questions that don't have easy answers. So what is the next one? Well, you know, our president has to be careful what he wears, because the press conference suddenly talks more about the color of his suit than the content of what he's commenting on. Or when he says that we don't have a strategy, suddenly, you know, that can be taken out of context. You know, I just think it's a real challenge for us. And, it, you know, I was thinking when you asked this question earlier, where do we go to? Well, you know, here we are having a detailed, informed, you know, program today about that. That's the kind of thing we need to have, conversations that allow us to speak beyond just the headlines, and those conversations, you know, not just in this setting, but, you know, with people and just being able to try and, well, try to dig a little deeper.
Brad?
I'm not sure I'm going to give you the answer you like. Let me first say that we're talking, so much of what our discussion is about is terrorism, say, in South Asia and or Central Asia and in the Middle East, areas with which, frankly, I would have to confess to being a dilettante. So let me talk about Asia, where I think that I know. And we've heard sort of pieces of I think, where the solutions have to come from the conversations, particularly Wendy's and remarks and John's too. We need a whole-of-government approach. We need – you know, one of the things I'm always telling the young people that we engage with is that – Organizations, different places, people, jobs think differently about problems. I think we do well to bring more folks in that look at these problems in different ways to see if maybe they've got methodologies and toolkits that we haven't thought about that you would use, the civil society person uses, that the military person doesn't. And mixing and matching, recognizing, of course, that these are enduring problems. They've been with us for decades, generations, hundreds of years. They're not going to go away. All we have to do is nibble at them. So we have to have appropriate expectations. We have to be engaging the people, I think, that are closest to them, which is, I think, what Wendy was talking about, and John as well. You know, the pity, and I say this with all due respect to our military colleagues here, and actually I think it's a sign of you know, sort of a recognition, they've borne too much of the burden. The fact of the matter is that we should be engaging more forward with our diplomacy and with business and not forcing the military to do all of this stuff, because that puts the engagement and the perceptions of those engagement within a very particular prism. And that is, quite frankly, what the intention of the rebalance to Asia is really about, is to recalibrate the weights within that particular diplomatic toolkit.
Which is what we heard from John Kerry when he was here a few
right.
weeks ago at the East West Center.
And it's a longstanding issue, but it's also one that which, frankly, at the end of the day, it's easier to fund a bunch of aircraft carriers than it is, or marine deployments, than it is to send out a bunch of diplomats. So that engagement, that diversified form of engagement. Finally, I think we have to empower, precisely as was being said, the people that are closest to the problem. They have respect, they have perspectives, they have an ability to address these issues in different ways, and they have a credibility in the audiences. And then finally, and I think this is what's really difficult, is what we have to call, we have to trust our friends and our allies, our partners, to work together. But at the same time, we have to be ready to call out those same people when they pursue their national interests in ways that we perceive as being deleterious to our own. So, for example, you know,
Pakistan?
Exactly. That would be one of them. But similarly, the Saudis was mentioned as one of our really key partners in the Middle East. Well, the Saudis have been funding Osama bin Laden. There's some questions about which of the other terrorist groups in – and not the Saudi government, although it may well be, but there are money trails that come from certain parts of the Saudi royal family that have funded various groups. And so we need to be quick to acknowledge the complexities, and we have to demand that our partners – not abandon their national interests, but at least to come to a better understanding of what it is, and to attach potential costs to doing things that are flat out in that go against and undermine American national interests.
One final question for all of you, very quickly, because we're coming to the end of the hour. Are ISIL's days really numbered, and will they be taken out by other than any sort of world coalition? Taken out by others who want to just see them gone?
I would say yes. I don't see nationhood. I just see this evil running amok throughout this poor, beleaguered part of the world. I see it either collapsing and fracturing itself or the region hopefully rallying and maybe with our support putting them away.
Carlos?
I mean, I think, yeah, he's put it very well. You know, at some level, you're already seeing that response from different leaders. And the question is, how will they be able to coalesce around some response? I mean, the particular challenge is the case of Syria, because here's a country that's got a very, you know, ongoing internal civil war. And yet, how can we intervene in that place? But at some point, if the cost gets high for its leader, you know, there's obviously negotiations ongoing that might allow some, you know, some cooperation to take on this specific challenge.
Wendy?
I agree with both of them that the response from the global community is going to ramp up. And targeting ISIS is going to be much easier than targeting other groups in terms of where they're located in their safe haven that they've taken up, like Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Much harder problem, and other groups that are fueling the insurgency in Afghanistan. Much harder to fight in that type of environment than in Iraq. I think ISIS is also alienating probably more than they are recruiting. So there are tactics, and which I think is part of what you're seeing between Al-Qaeda and ISIS and why they're distancing themselves, because, the overly heavy-handed tactics, I think Al-Qaeda learned that lesson. And, you know, their recent rhetoric has been not to harm other Muslims and not to have that type of heavy-handedness, because it's going to backlash against them. So, yes, I think that, you know, we'll be able to deal with ISIS. I just hope we learn the lesson, though, of what can potentially happen when we do step back too far and we disengage too far and allow these types of safe havens and groups to really gain momentum.
Brad Glosserman, you can have cleanup.
I think the Islamic State is history, or will be. Everybody pretty much wants them gone, with some rare exceptions. And the fact that they've taken territory makes them a target. The Islamic State as a movement, however, I think is likely to be with us. I think to follow up on Wendy's comment, another lesson we should learn is the enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend. And, you know, there's a binary choice. We can go after ISIS or IS in Syria, or we can continue to undermine the Assad regime. You can't do both. That's going to be one of the most formidable forces fighting IS. And so we have to eschew these extremely simplistic statements about how these politics and these dyads happen to work out. But I also don't have a sense that there's much of a leadership structure. You take out Bakar, public enemy number Alpha Omega One.
And then what?
Yes, I don't see there's much left for that organization. But the bad guys that they've recruited that are attracted to that sort of activity, if they don't go to IS, then they'll go to Al-Qaeda. They'll go somewhere else. So we always have to be vigilant, and we have to make sure both in, you know, taking the innocents out that are recruited because they have nothing to lose. And then we have to really go after the bad guys that kind of like the lawlessness and like the ability to behead other human beings, and somehow that makes them feel good about themselves and who they are. The terrorist organizations that we have discussed by and large have been Islamic groups. And I think it's really important to underscore that no religion has a monopoly on extremist violence, and that just because these groups are absorbing us or are the focus of our attention today doesn't mean that there is a particular problem with Islam, nor that there are other religious groups and fringe crazies that we should not be paying attention to.
I want to thank you all for making time to come in so we could have this conversation. We'll do it again sometime.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Carlos Juarez, Brad Glosserman, retired U.S. Army Colonel John Hansen, and Lieutenant Colonel Wendy Marotta, a reservist in the U.S. Marine Corps, and you too. Next week, we'll be back with a live show, and the phone lines will be open. We'll see you then.